This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The percentage of Wisconsin high school students enrolling directly into college is falling. As Rich Kramer reports, the decline is gradual but has big implications for institutions already facing significant and long-term enrollment challenges.
UW-Platteville's Richland campus is mostly quiet on this cold Wednesday in February. The only sounds come from the babbling Brush Creek and an occasional car pulling onto campus. Freshmen Jackson Kinney and Heath Zumach are studying alone in the Wallace Student Center cafeteria. Kinney says he's heard there are only 60 students at the campus, down from the fall enrollment count of 75.
Will this campus be here in 5 years? I've heard that question a lot, and we hope it is, but with enrollment this low, it makes you wonder how that is able to happen and how they're able to support themselves.
Kinney says he likes the small class sizes and is saving money by staying close to home. But enrollment at UW-Platteville Richland has fallen by nearly 87% from a peak of 567 students in 2014. Between 2010 and 2021, the UW's 13 two-year campuses lost about 7,400 students. UW System Chief Data Analyst Ben Passmore says that's a huge challenge, in part because two-year campuses are access points for students who may not go to college otherwise.
It seems pretty clear that the attractiveness of that kind of associate route, or certainly to follow that all the way through the associate's degree and transfer, declined over this last decade. I don't have a great theory as to why.
Passmore says one thing is clear. Fewer high school graduates in Wisconsin are going directly to college. His office is analyzing data from the State Department of Public Instruction, showing 59% of grads in 2015 enrolled as freshmen the same year. In 2019, that fell to 56%. The decline was higher among men than women. And at Wisconsin Technical Colleges, enrollment fell by more than 34% over the last decade. Administrators attribute that to a strong economy, low birth rates, and an aging population. Technical College System President Morna Foy says two-year college enrollment typically increases with unemployment, but that didn't happen despite job losses during the pandemic.
You know, typical decline around 2 to 3% annually. Dropped to 19% over the last 2 years.
She says new challenges for working parents, like the loss of child care options and public school closures, likely meant a pause for tech college plans. As for the longer trend, Foy says higher education is changing, and more people are seeking degrees or certifications after starting careers. And more high schools are offering associate degree programs. Some two-year UW System campuses are responding by offering four-year bachelor's degrees. That's what UW-Green Bay's locations in Manitowoc, Marinette, and Sheboygan started doing in 2019. They're the only UW two-year campuses to see enrollment grow in the last 2 years. Chancellor Michael Alexander says the university is purposely ceding ground to area technical colleges.
We're still going to offer associate's degrees as part of what we do, but we're not going to compete for a student who's choosing between us and the technical college.
Sarah Burmish is in her third year of classes on UW-Green Bay's Sheboygan campus. She's saving money on her nursing degree by going to school in her hometown. The five-year program is split between the Sheboygan campus, a nearby tech college, and a year of online classes at UW-Green Bay.
This was a really safe option just to come and take some classes while I was trying to figure out my life.
The declining number of high school graduates going directly to college in Wisconsin means schools are going to have to figure out more ways to meet students like Burmish where they are. It's a critical challenge for institutions hoping to adapt and reverse long-term enrollment declines. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, millions of people have fled Ukraine to escape the Russian invasion. Most have crossed into Poland, and the United States announced it would accept up to 100,000 refugees and will continue to send aid to Eastern Europe. Over the weekend, President Biden met with refugees in Poland and called on countries around the world to step up and help meet that need.
Helping these refugees is not something Poland or any other nation should carry alone. All the world democracies have a responsibility to help. All of them. And the people of Ukraine can count on the United States to meet its responsibility.
The refugee crisis has raised questions about what the United States' responsibility is and how the country's handling these refugees compared to other humanitarian crises around the world. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think the United States should play in the Ukrainian refugee crisis? Were you glad to hear the U.S. is accepting up to 100,000 refugees from Ukraine? Should that number be higher, do you think? What questions do you have about the refugee resettlement process? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. She's chair there of the Public and Environmental Affairs Unit. Elise, welcome back to Central Time.
It's great to be with you, Rob.
We're seeing these numbers coming out of Ukraine. Can you talk about the scope of this refugee crisis, the number of people, the pace at which they've been displaced, and fit it into our perspective on other recent displacements around the world?
Absolutely. We are looking at about 3.8 million, quote, refugees, meaning they have fled across the borders of Ukraine. Internally, we have way more than that. We have around 6.5 million estimated to be internally displaced, so that they are still within the borders of Ukraine, but they have been forcibly driven from their homes. So all in all, that's around 10 million people, but it grows every week. And most of those are women and children because, of course, men between the ages of 18 and 60 have been restricted from leaving.
How is the level of support for Ukrainian refugees compared with other big humanitarian crises in recent years?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's been some attention around that, especially the really disparate treatment of Ukrainian refugees compared with Syrian refugees. If listeners remember back in 2014, 2015, the Syrian refugee crisis was actually called the greatest refugee crisis in the world since World War II. And if we notice, the Ukrainian refugee situation is being called the greatest refugee crisis in Europe since World War II. And there's something about that European aspect and the racial and cultural component of it that factors in as well, that has created a much more receptive and welcoming response to Ukrainians compared with Syrians and others from the Middle East and Central Asia and Africa in the last few years.
I want to give a listen to a recent interview we did. We know Poland is bearing the brunt of the refugee crisis. 2 weeks ago here on Central Time, we talked to UW-Platteville professor Andrei Ivanov, who joined the show from Krakow, Poland, where he was helping his Ukrainian parents with their escape from Ukraine.
The Polish people are very welcoming, and they are opening up their homes, and they're opening up their hearts, and they're helping, and they're feeding. And the students at the university in Krakow here are very active in volunteer work, in help, in finding clothing. A lot of stores, I see things, basic things, pharmacies are empty because they're trying to buy up medications for the refugees who couldn't take them with them. If you have only an hour to pack up your bags and leave your home, what are you going to take?
Can you talk about the humanitarian situation in Poland right now with so many Ukrainian refugees showing up across the border there?
Yes, definitely. Poland is hosting the most refugees at the moment. So over 2 million have fled directly to that neighbor. And this makes sense because Poland has already been a main destination for Ukrainians in recent years. Roughly 1 million Ukrainians were already working abroad in Poland. So there were a lot of connections established even before the war from Russia. And we also see a lot of cultural and historical connections between the country. You know, even the language, something like that matters in a moment like this when, you know, there's a mutual intelligibility between Polish and Ukrainian that eases interactions. The European Union, of course, has also discussed a fair burden sharing. So it shouldn't fall alone to countries like Poland or those immediate neighbors, Romania, Moldova, Hungary. The European Union has really stepped up in the sense of offering this temporary protection directive. It's essentially going to enable Ukrainians to have a clear legal status across the European Union for residence, for access to education, healthcare, employment, accommodations. They're really framing that as sort of welcoming Ukrainians as part of a European way of life.
The U.S. Announced a temporary protected status for Ukrainians already in the U.S. and says we'll accept 100,000 refugees from Ukraine. What are your thoughts on the scope of that reaction?
Yeah, that's a really interesting aspect, because if we would compare that to the Afghan refugee situation not too long ago, right, just this past fall here in the United States, We saw a lot of the similar momentum in the first couple of months for welcoming Afghans, especially those that had helped U.S. troops. And that number that the U.S. ended up evacuating for resettlement was a little over 70,000, around 76,000. So we can right away see that there is an increase in this number of 100,000 for the Ukrainian situation, and then a much more rapid response in terms of going ahead with, like you mentioned, the temporary protected status, which would enable at least 18 months to not worry about deportation for around 30,000 Ukrainians who are already here in the country. We also need to think about that number, that 100,000 is probably most will not be the formal refugee admissions program. A lot is probably going to be through that humanitarian parole or some visas, like there's this Lautenberg Amendment visa program that has for a long time protected religious minorities fleeing Ukraine. And so there could also be family reunification visas through that kind of program.
We're talking about the Ukrainian refugee crisis with Elise Cohen. She's an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the U.S. has a responsibility to help in the Ukrainian refugee crisis? If so, what do you think the U.S. role should be? Do you have questions about how this all works, the practical elements of getting help to refugees? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW Green Bay political science professor Elise Cohen about how the U.S. and Europe are handling millions of refugees leaving Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the U.S. do, if anything, when it comes to refugee relief for Ukrainians fleeing the Russian invasion? 800-642-1234 is the number for your comments or questions. Mike joins us now in Madison. Mike, hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is the first time in my 50 years on this planet that there's a true moral righteousness to go in and help people. So far in my lifetime in Vietnam, Korea never begged us for help. Vietnam never begged us for help. Kuwait didn't beg us for help. Iraq, Afghanistan, no one has begged us for help. Ukraine has gone on international television begging for help in a war that we should be morally and ethically involved in. It's the first time in United States history we've been asked to help legitimately, and we are not. And I find it completely appalling.
Mike, thanks for the call. I think Mike's referring to the military side of things here, Elise, which we've also talked about on the show. More, is there a moral obligation, I think, for the United States to help with refugees in a situation like Ukraine?
Yeah, I think that the caller there, Mike, is really tapping into something that aligns with a lot of the rhetoric coming from the Biden administration about why the U.S. has an obligation to share some of the responsibility for Ukrainian refugees. You know, President Biden has framed this as a fight between a democracy and an oligarch. And these refugees from Ukraine have really taken on the symbolic value of representing support for democratic values and support for human rights. So I think that's part of the reason why you can see this framing around a moral obligation and a sense of solidarity like the caller is referencing, because there really is this belief that Ukrainians are like us and share our values, and therefore we have an extra responsibility in this case.
Mike, thanks for calling in. Kevin joins us now in Deerfield. Kevin, hi.
Thank you. I am interested in the Ukrainian refugee situation and the possibility of some of them coming to Wisconsin. But you touched on the Afghan refugees and just, you know, thinking about how to handle the Ukrainian situation. Could you update us on what the Afghan refugee status is? Are they all here and still need to be placed? Are there more coming, or what is the status of that? And if there's anything else in terms of, the overall situation, I'd be.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Elise, are you tracking what's happening with Afghan refugees and people, as you mentioned, on the humanitarian parole provision in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, absolutely. Kevin raises a really great point there. So around 76,000 Afghans were admitted into the United States after that Taliban takeover from August, and roughly 67,000 of those have already been processed now at the U.S. military sites. So essentially, right before this war unfolded with Ukraine, the U.S. government was saying, look, we've finished the first phase of the resettlement for the Afghan evacuees, and a lot of them have been moved out of that temporary housing on the bases to actually get resettled into local communities. And I think we have around 800 or so have been resettled in Wisconsin, at least 160 just right down the way from where I am, down in Milwaukee. So that has been in progress. However, there's this really big backlog, and there are still thousands of Afghans waiting at bases overseas, for example, in Qatar and the UAE, that have not yet had the processing occur. And then we haven't been able to evacuate still yet many thousands more who are at risk of abduction and killing and kidnapping of their family members still in Afghanistan, internally displaced. So there are concerns from some lawmakers that were really advocating for those Afghans from the start, that remains unfinished, and attention to it has kind of faded or waned into the background now that we have this new focus on a different refugee situation.
Kevin, thanks for that call. Elise, we had talked about changes in U.S. refugee policy in recent years, the numbers cut down, for example, during the Trump administration. Do we have the infrastructure, whether that's government agencies, relief groups here in Wisconsin and elsewhere, to be able to quickly and efficiently do something like bring 100,000 Ukrainian refugees and others into the country?
Yeah, Rob, that's the really tough question, because we did see with the Trump presidency that we went from around 100,000 or so with the refugee admission ceiling from the Obama administration all the way down each year to 15,000 by the end of that term in 2020. And as part of that process, there was a dismantling of the infrastructure for resettlement, and a lot of the resources really scaled back, even, you know, staffing really scaled back for refugee resettlement. And so part of the problem is, even aside from the Ukraine refugee situation, we saw the Biden administration has been making very slow progress on meeting its stated goal, even for this fiscal year. The stated fiscal year cap is 125,000 for refugees, but we're just around 7,000 people that have actually been able to be processed. So the backlog and the lack of resources and the dismantling by the previous administration does have a legacy effect.
Talking to Elise Cohen from UW-Green Bay about Ukrainian refugees, U.S. efforts at relief in Eastern Europe and here at home. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say that I don't think we should be making these foolish excuses. This is the most powerful and the most wealthy country in the world. And I'd like to also remind people what it says on the Statue of Liberty. Give me my tired, give me your tired, your hungry, and your poor, your wretched refuse, yearning to be free. I lift my lamp beside the golden shore. This country can absorb anything. This country can do anything.
Linda, thanks for the call. Elise, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that Linda is really tapping into a lot of the Biden administration's emphasis that the U.S. should restore our global leadership with that kind of message that Linda is bringing from the Statue of Liberty, that we're really a safe haven and it's part of American identity. And you can see that distinction with Biden talking in terms of responsibility sharing, saying this Ukraine situation is not just a Europe or a NATO problem. It is a global responsibility, and the U.S. needs to play a leadership role. And that's really different, with that emphasis on multilateralism and working collectively, from the America First vision that we had seen when the resettlement program was taken down. So I think that kind of messaging and that framing really has an impact for people.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Elise, how about relief for people, Ukrainians in Poland and other neighboring countries who are hoping, I think, many of them to have a short stay and to find themselves back in Ukraine as soon as it is safe to do so? What are the key things for relief, keeping them sheltered and fed and things like that?
Yeah, that's another important angle of this. And the Biden administration did announce, as part of the 100,000 being possibly admitted last week, that there would also be this aid package of $1 billion in humanitarian assistance to Poland and to other Eastern European ally countries. And that is supposed to be targeted for humanitarian aid for food, shelter, clean water, and medical supplies. So we can see that there's a lot of outpouring of the support in the humanitarian aid, not only from the civil society and the people themselves offering their homes and offering donations, but in the form of real government assistance that they will be investing for that.
And we got a question via our website from Mavis, who says, how could a person volunteer to take a Ukrainian family into their home? Elise, I don't know if we're at that stage yet, but in general, if people want to say, yeah, I want to open up my house to a refugee family or do what I can, what kind of things did you point them toward?
Well, there is a very interesting new pilot program that the Biden administration was trying out, mainly in response to facilitating Afghan refugee resettlement. And we'll have to watch and see now if it can be used for the Ukraine situation. But it's called Sponsor Circle Program. And I would encourage listeners, if they're interested, to just look up the Sponsor Circle Program. They're trying out this private sponsorship with small groups of Americans pooling together their funds to form a sponsor circle, commit to assisting refugees for the first 3 months they're here with things like registering children for school, locating housing and jobs, and undergoing background checks, taking online courses, you know, to ensure the sponsors are really well equipped to do that work. But anyone who wants to look can check out the Sponsor Circle program and see the website if it will move beyond Afghan refugees. Another thing would just be to work with the Wisconsin resettlement agencies that are really involved, like Lutheran Social Services or Jewish Social Services. So we have a number of groups even here in the state. And of course, a lot of civil society groups are taking donations at this time.
Elise, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you, Rob.
Elise Cohen is an associate professor of political science at UW Green Bay. She was with us today looking at the treatment of Ukrainian refugees fleeing the Russian invasion and the U.S. role in providing relief. Still time for you to share your thoughts. You can always email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, there's a big demand for mental health care in Wisconsin schools, but there's not always enough staff to meet those needs. We've had recent conversations on that topic. Check out a program at UW-La Crosse that's trying to meet that demand and provide these staff psychologists of the future for schools. That's tomorrow morning on the Ideas Network. Here's something that came up over the weekend. When you were a kid, did you ever get a special home remedy when you were sick that when you look back seems kind of weird? My examples for a stomach ache, my grandma would give me Coke syrup, like the stuff you'd mix with carbonated water to make Coca-Cola. For just about anything, I was from Michigan, the magical catch-all remedy was Verner's ginger ale, which is a big Michigan thing. Disclaimer, I'm not making any medical claims about either of those products. Also, one time my grandpa suggested giving me a shot of brandy for my sore throat. I was 9 at the time. My parents didn't run with that one. I asked around the Central Time team, Rachel Vasquez. She was a boring chicken super. Dean Canetter said Sprite and saltines. And Emily Burdett says her mom tried feeding her white rice in hot water, like a mushy, bland rice soup. Emily found it disgusting. If you've got something like that, let us know. Email centraltime@WPR.org. That's centraltime@WPR.org. Or tweet your weird childhood home remedy at @CentralTimeWPR. A spoonful of syrup. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the coldest place on Earth recently had a record-setting heat wave. We'll talk to a Madison College instructor about what's behind the high temperatures in Antarctica and hear about his recent trip there to help collect weather and climate data. Now, a pair of women in Green Bay are hoping to help others who have recently gone through a divorce or other breakup with an online gift registry. Their website sets the goal of bringing dignity to people who are going through this tough time in their lives. Eliza Cousin and Beth Paulson are co-founders of the new company called Divorcist. Eliza, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
And Beth, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, Beth, can you start by talking about the need you both saw for a resource like a gift registry for someone coming out of a divorce or a breakup?
Yes, for sure. Women, we've always celebrated the big happy times, like marriages and babies. But a lot of the times when you need help, it's when you're going through the not so great times. And when you're going through a divorce, you definitely need, you often need the financial assistance and the physical durable goods that you would get with a breakup with a registry.
Eliza, can you talk about this on a practical level? When I think about it, I guess most couples probably don't have two blenders or what have you.
Right, exactly. When you break up a domestic partnership and a marriage, it means splitting your life in two. So that often means that you are missing 50% of the things that you're used to having in a household. But more than that, I think it's really about reframing this time in our lives and making it okay to ask for help. There's the practicalities of like, yes, I need a new smoothie blender, but also it's just enabling community support, which I think is something so vital to people, but particularly women going through a major breakup.
Beth, you mentioned people, you know, might use a registry for those happy times, getting married, the new kid. How is divorces similar to those kind of registries? How is it different?
Well, it's similar in that it can definitely be a celebration. You can give gifts because you're happy and because you're moving on to a new part of your life. So it symbolizes the beginning of something new, which in many cases is very, very good. So it can be a celebration. It's different in that we have heightened security features for people. It's not as easy. It's impossible to get a user's address because domestic violence is a factor in breakups so much of the time.
Now, Eliza, this is a technology startup, but you're not, in the Bay Area in Silicon Valley. You're in the Green Bay area. Can you talk about challenges starting up this tech startup here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, the other Bay Area. Or I'm trying to make Silicon Lakeshore like a thing. So help it spread, bro. But yeah, I think there is an assumption that companies like ours can only come out of the coast. And that innovation doesn't happen in the Midwest or in these small to medium cities like Green Bay. So what we're really doing is, you know, pioneering and proving to everyone that two moms can start a business that can be valued at, you know, multi-millions of dollars. I think we are at a bit of a disadvantage as founders being up here because there just isn't that network. You know, we can't go out to a networking dinner in San Francisco and be introduced to 20 people who will invest in us or mentor us. Instead, we might go to 20 networking dinners and meet 3 people. But then at the other side of things, everyone we do meet is so excited and so willing to support us. There's a real sense of optimism about small business and startups happening in small cities. And Green Bay is no exception. And we're very grateful for all the local support we've received.
And speaking of small business, Beth, did I see on your registry you try, at least when possible, to steer people toward gifts they can get from smaller businesses?
Yep, absolutely. We're looking for partnerships, of course, across the board, big and small. But at this point, we really want to help sustain the smaller businesses, which, as we've experienced, can often be more women-owned or minority-owned, just to kind of level the playing field in our small way.
Eliza, you had a soft launch of Divorcest, I understand, in the late fall, the full-on going live earlier this month. How are things going so far?
We're thrilled. We're overjoyed by the reception. We're seeing all the signups go up and up every day. And we're just thrilled. You know, we had some doubters either, you know, say that there wouldn't be a market for this or that this was just people clamoring for gifts and being tasteless. But instead, what we're seeing is this overwhelming need for our service straight away. So, you know, we've been live for just 4 weeks and we are hard at work supporting our first customers and helping people build their newly single lives.
Beth, I wonder, suppose somebody out there is listening and has been thinking, I got this great idea for a startup, a business I could do here in Wisconsin, but I don't see myself as an entrepreneur. I'm not like a fancy, wealthy person in the Silicon Valley area. What would you say to them to encourage them to at least explore that notion?
Well, I would say it does certainly help, I would imagine, to be a wealthy person in the Bay Area. But if you're a normal mom from Green Bay, Wisconsin, there actually are resources out there. The Blueprint Green Bay does amazing work with the Chamber of Commerce. It's an emerging field. We feel like we're right kind of at the crest of the wave of this new interest being taken in women co-founders and minority co-founders. So it's becoming a little bit more open to just everyday people.
We'll leave it there. Beth and Eliza, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Eliza Cousin and Beth Paulson are co-founders of the Green Bay-based gift registry website for newly single people. It's called Divorcist. We talked to them about the needs they're trying to address with their business and what it's been like as female-led tech startups not based in Silicon Valley. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about a friendly debate between two beloved Wisconsin desserts.
We recently received an audience question through WPR's Wisconsin Project about two iconic Wisconsin pastries, the cream puff and the kringle. WPR's Tim Peterson was up to the task of getting to the bottom, or at least the delicious sugary middle, of what separates them.
Marissa Wojcik of Madison grew up in the Eau Claire area, regularly consuming kringle at family gatherings. Her experience with cream puff, on the other hand, is limited. Just one puff. And it did not blow her away, which prompted her to ask us,
why do cream puffs get all the attention when the kringle is the official state pastry of Wisconsin?
Well, certainly cream puffs have been a signature dessert of the Wisconsin State Fair since 1924.
Paula Hare is Director of Marketing and Media Relations for Original Cream Puffs. That's the pop-up bakery from the Wisconsin Bakers Association responsible for making and serving cream puffs for that annual 11-day run.
It is certainly the most popular and longest-running food item at the state fair. I mean, picture in your mind, you know, all of the sights and sounds of the fair and the giant Ferris wheel lights, and having your first cream puff is certainly an experience just like going to the fair. Our cream puffs are made from Wisconsin dairy-rich cream and also a very wonderful puff pastry, and biting into them is just like a little piece of heaven.
But some people push back on our very serious kringle versus cream puff premise.
Well, cream puffs are delightful. This is the most friendly debate ever.
Shauna Seaver, author of the cookbook Midwest Made, Big Bold Baking from the Heartland. She also had thoughts on the cream puff.
Is that nostalgic feel of the state fair, and it's something special that you're not going to have all the time. I mean, and it's something that's like towering and beautiful and delightful and a little over the top, and I think definitely has a place.
Now, for the official state pastry, so anointed by the legislature in 2013, here's Seaver again.
Well, Kringle came to Wisconsin in the late 1800s when there was a huge boom of immigrants from all over Europe in particular, and Wisconsin took a lot of them in, and it became a sort of landing place for a lot of very baking-centric countries, lucky for Wisconsin. And the kringle was an invention from Denmark, originally actually started out in a sort of pretzel shape, and you still find them in Denmark baked in that way. And then, like so many other baked goods, sort of evolve as they land in their new home, and like any innovative group of immigrants, they sort of tweaked the kringle a little bit for local tastes, and it's been around ever since.
We wanted to dig a little deeper, get under the crust of what separates these two. Seaver gives us a quick lesson, starting with the cream puff.
In terms of the technique, choux pastry comes together rather quickly, and you can bake it, you know, straight out of the mixer. And then you can dollop your puffs, and then they're baked off. And then when you're talking about Kringle, it's actually based on a Danish pastry, which is kind of similar to a French puff pastry, but there's the addition of yeast, which gives it a little more rise and, of course, that delicious flavor. But it's a laminated dough, which essentially means that you're going to incorporate the butter by rolling and folding the dough several times. So it can be a couple day process to make yourself a good Kringle, which I think is something that a lot of us take for granted because it's something easy to sort of grab and have, you know, for coffee breaks. But they really are very well-crafted, time-consuming pastry.
And like the cream puff, Kringle has a special yet different place in our hearts.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story about two beloved Wisconsin pastries. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a Madison College instructor joins the show to tell us about his work building weather stations in Antarctica and to talk about how that data is then used to research climate change. That's up next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Antarctica is the coldest continent on Earth, but earlier this month, a record-setting heat wave shook things up. Our next guest is part of a team that makes weather measurements like that possible. He builds weather stations across Antarctica that collect all kinds of data, and then researchers use that data to study things, including climate change. Lee Wellhouse is a physical sciences instructor at Madison College. He's also an instrumentation engineer with UW-Madison's Automatic Weather Station project. He recently got back from a trip to Antarctica. Lee, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I wanted to ask you about your first day on the job. You walk out to clock in, and you're in Antarctica. What was that first look at this continent like for you?
So it was about a decade ago now. So it's always tough to like look back at how I remember things, but it's interesting. You get off of a plane and you're not landing on a runway. You're landing on an ice runway. So you get off and you're on an ice sheet and you see in every direction, nothing but ice sheet, maybe some mountains off in the distance that are covered in ice. It's very similar, somewhat similar to Wisconsin in winter, but just amped up to 11.
I would probably say Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra, as I stepped off. That's me. But what can you tell us about the work you do on these weather stations in Antarctica?
Oh, absolutely. So we have a network of around 60 weather stations, and we've been running a program for the National Science Foundation for the past 40 years. And a part of that is maintaining the weather stations. Antarctica is a very difficult place to have equipment. Everything breaks. It's cold, it's windy, things fall apart, and you can only be there for a few months out of the year. So every year we have to go to a subset of the sites and fix things because various things will fall off, various things will break, just eventually everything degrades. So, and things get buried by snow. So we're digging up equipment, we're raising it back to the correct heights, and then making sure everything's in good shape, working and transmitting so we're actually getting all the data.
And you recently got back from a trip to Antarctica. You know, our winter, I believe, is Antarctica's summer. Correct me if I'm wrong. Tell us a little bit about
that's perfectly correct.
Yeah, what did you see there? What were things like in this Antarctic summer?
So it was actually a pretty interesting year this year. We mainly stayed in the McMurdo base, which is the main U.S. base. So we didn't get far afield. We didn't go to South Pole this year. We didn't go to West Antarctica, which involves camping, but we did get to go to a number of sites on the Ross Ice Shelf, which is ice shelf that's closest to McMurdo, and got to see a lot of cold, a lot of snow, and I like to think of it as Wisconsin winter, only instead of it being dark most of the time, it's sunny all the time and similar temperatures.
Now, just after you left, people may have seen this in the news, a record heat wave in Antarctica. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, so that happened in East Antarctica. So for those listening, Antarctica can be split into East and West Antarctica. East Antarctica is higher. It's a much higher plateau, much colder, and a much larger area than West Antarctica. And they recently got what we call an atmospheric river, basically a really strong storm system moving into the area, bringing a lot of moisture and a lot of energy. And normally these systems just rotate around the continent. This one actually forced its way into East Antarctica and sat there for around a week. And it's dark most of the day at this point, and closer to the coast, it was getting a little bit of sunlight, but not much. And we're in the point of basically 24 hours of darkness. To see massive temperature increases is relatively rare. But it's caused by basically that energy being brought in, cloud cover keeping that energy from being able to escape to space, and just staying nice and warm, which is, again, super rare. And by warm, I mean still 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
But that's 70 degrees warmer than normal, right? That's a big difference.
Oh, yes, it's absolutely. It's a massive, massive difference from what they're normally seeing. And now this week, they're back to their normal temperatures in the like negative 60s, negative 80s temperatures.
We're talking to Madison College instructor Lee Wellhouse about his work with UW-Madison's Automatic Weather Station project, which collects data from Antarctica. All right, Lee, your instruments are there. You've repaired them. The data comes through. What then do we learn from all this weather data?
So we get to learn a lot of interesting things. So first of all, we're learning about the weather systems that are impacting specific locations. And that's super important from a perspective of we want to work there. Other science wants to be done there. It helps us forecast. It helps us understand what we're getting into because you're far away from civilization. So that helps us do our work and other groups do their work safely. It also allows us to understand the climate of Antarctica. It's a unique location. Different things are going on, and we can monitor it and understand it better going forward.
There was more Antarctic news lately, an ice shelf in East Antarctica collapsing. Why is that significant?
So it's East Antarctica has been a very, very stable environment for ice and ice shelves and ice sheets for the entirety of the satellite record. So the past 40 years, that we haven't had an ice sheet collapse. West Antarctica, by comparison, has had a lot more ice sheets collapse. Ice shelves have issues, and we're seeing a lot more ice loss in that region. So to see things like this happening in East Antarctica is a bit unexpected and also a bit more like newsworthy and a bit concerning.
Concerning why?
Again, because if we're expecting that area to be more stable, for these ice sheets to be more consistent and not collapse in this way, by seeing them collapse, that tells us that things are changing in this region to some degree. Not as extensively as West Antarctica, but we're still seeing the change in the ice dynamics and in the climate of the East Antarctica.
Yeah, with the urgency of climate change, how big a piece of the puzzle is getting a better understanding of what's going on in Antarctica for what's going to affect us and the rest of the planet?
It's a pretty massive part of the puzzle, especially, like I mentioned, West Antarctica, we're seeing a lot more ice loss and issues with ice sheet collapse. And there have been recent news about the Thwaites Glacier and the possibility of collapse there. These all play a major role in sea level change in the near future. The ice sheets collapsing themselves, I want to be clear, those aren't going to impact sea ice directly. But by getting rid of those ice sheets, you expose the glaciers that are land-based behind them to the water. Basically, they're able to dump their ice into the water more directly, and that does raise sea level, and that is a major problem.
Right, so the ice sheets on the water are kind of like a plug for the ice sheets on the land, and when that land stuff starts to hit the water, that's, if I'm hearing you right, that's when sea levels around the world can go up?
That's exactly correct. That's generally how it works. Basically, like you said, they act as a plug or a dam that's sitting there, and they act as a buffer. And when that buffer's gone, things can speed up and the dynamics can change rapidly.
What for you, Lee, are the most interesting or important questions that we still don't have answers for when it comes to weather and climate in Antarctica?
Well, that's a tough question because they're it's a unique place. Obviously, just Antarctica being a large continent and not having a lot of observations, we just need more observations in more places. It's just we're getting a better understanding of the areas we're able to get to, but just it's a big place. There's a lot of things that can go sort of overlooked or missed because we don't have observations in all the locations, and satellites help us with that, but there's still more to be done there.
A lot of big questions there, Lee, but I gotta ask, do you ever have moments where you're like, I'm standing on Antarctica, like I'm part of this like incredibly small percentage of all the humans who ever lived who are on this continent?
Oh, absolutely. That happens every year, and it's a big part. It's a feeling that brings me back every year.
Lee, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's Lee Wellhouse. He's an instrumentation engineer with UW-Madison's Automatic Weather Station project in Antarctica and a physical sciences instructor at Madison College. He was with us today to talk about his work in Antarctica and a record heat wave that hit that continent. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, lobbying broke records last year with businesses and interest groups spending big in the nation's capital. Find out what's driving that trend and what kind of influence that money can buy. Plus, get an update on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and efforts by the U.S. and NATO to help Ukraine without provoking a wider conflict. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.